With apologies to myself, I guess, this thought to start us off today. The Shanghai Composite Index is not the Chinese economy, and the Chinese economy is not the Shanghai Composite Index. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 27th of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Here's what I want you to do for me as we get going today. Take those stories you have been hearing and reading and seeing all day long about the Chinese stock market, how the main Shanghai index was off 8.5% today, and how the end may very well be nigh. I want you to take all those stories and very, very slowly back away from your monitor. No, I get it. It's not comforting to see markets in the world's second biggest economy take a nosedive, but trust me, it's going to be okay. Probably. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Given what our markets went through only a few years ago during the Great Recession, China's stock market nosedive might seem a little terrifying. But it shouldn't, at least not for us.
China's financial markets are mostly closed off to those outside of the country.
Nadege Roland is Senior Project Director for the National Bureau of Asian Research.
So of all the shares in Chinese stock markets, foreigners own less than 2%.
One of the many reasons for this is so the Chinese government can maintain control over its market and do things like threaten to arrest people who sell off shares. The real linkages to China, though, are through its actual economy. Even there, though, the impacts are
real but limited.
Nicholas Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute.
China is about 7% of our exports, and exports are not a really huge chunk of our overall economy. So only about a percentage of our production is getting sold in China.
So no cause for panic there. Patrick Chovanec is chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. He says it's a mistake to think that all growth is good growth and any kind of slowdown in China must be bad.
That's not really the case. A lot of the growth that has taken place over the past 5 or 6 years in China was bad growth, credit-fueled investment and overinvestment.
So he says if China's slowdown means that its economy can correct and become more of a consumer-based economy, buying from the world instead of selling to it, that could ultimately benefit everyone. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are days when the big news stories fit together hand in glove, and this is one of them. Crude oil closed at four-month lows today, down around $47 a barrel in New York. And to be sure, only a fool covers daily gyrations in traditionally volatile commodities. But it does look like there are some bigger things going on in crude right now than just price. See also China. Marketplace's Scott Tong covers oil from the sustainability desk for us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, not too long ago, you and I were talking about oil coming back to, you know, plus or minus $60 a barrel.
Yeah.
What gives?
Well, if you can imagine going up on the diving board and diving into a pool of light crude, we are all swimming in it. You'll recall Thanksgiving Day last year when OPEC signaled that they're not going to cut supply anymore and they're going to keep pumping. Well, the world has been pumping. Saudi is at record levels. Iraq oil is back in a big way. Libya, U.S. shale oil from fracking was supposed to get shut down or slowed by these low prices, but production here keeps going. And now we have Iranian oil that could come back because of this potential lifting of energy sanctions after this nuclear deal. As one analyst put it, nobody's quite uncle. And so this bear market is a reaction to this unexpected glut. And then, Kai, we have this the demand side of all this. And as you know, China is the world's number two consumer of oil.
Behind us, we should say, right?
Way behind us, yes. You know, we talk about the Shanghai stock market not representing maybe anything about China. But there's other data, like industrial profits and factory output, all suggesting, you know, China is slowing down on the demand side.
Talk to me for a minute then about the cyclical nature of all this stuff, right? I mean, what's to say that in, you know, I don't know, 3.5 weeks or 3 months, you and I aren't back talking about oil at $100 a pop?
Big debate about that. I mean, some analysts think we may not see $100 oil for maybe 5 years or so, that this glut is going to last for a long time. A lot of drillers are cutting their investments, a total of $200 billion investments, to stay afloat if prices stay low for a long time. And if you want to go really gloomy, Morgan Stanley likens this to the 86 oil crash, which took the U.S. industry about 2 decades to recover.
Wow.
So that's one camp. The other says, you know, we may be in this new period of crazy volatility. before, you know, before last Thanksgiving, OPEC was known as kind of the price shock absorber in the oil markets, but they don't want to do that anymore. So perhaps we've entered this kind of boom-bust chamber, Kai.
Who, if we think about this globally, who's hurting most from this?
Well, let's play around the world. In Canada, up north, in the oil sands area of Alberta, where it's expensive to drill, unemployment has doubled there. Most of the new projects are shelved. We can go to Venezuela, which is running out of petroleum revenue dollars to buy imports, and everything there is imported, so people have to line up for hours to buy toilet paper, and inflation there is more than 100%. Huh. Russia is careening toward recession. The Gulf of Mexico, drilling rigs have fallen by 1,000. Tens of thousands of layoffs announced here in the States. I mean, yeah, enough?
you can just stop right there. What do we know, though, Scott, about the rate of increase in our oil demand, right? Because that plays into a whole bunch of different things.
Well, we talk all the time about our oil addiction, and we think it's just going up and up and up. But actually, according to the International Energy Agency, the big rich countries in the world, the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan, their demand is already declining. And the emerging economies, yes, they're buying more. But if you aggregate all of the global demand, which has been growing at like 2% or so every year, it's going down to 1%. The International Energy Agency says it's going down to flat, to zero growth, perhaps around 2040. So, you know, there's halting the growth at the very least. And China's a big part of this, and not just because of its slowdown, but it's getting less oil dependent, perhaps because of all those years of triple-digit crude have a lot of us changing our behavior. Now, is that enough behavior change to keep, you know, planetary warming under 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit or less? Not at this rate, but, you know, we'll have that other conversation later.
Scott Tong at the Sustainability Desk for us. Thank you, Scott.
All right. You're welcome.
Falling oil prices are not always a good thing if you are deep into equities. It's that falling demand thing Scott was just talking about. Also, for what it's worth, Janet Yellen at the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee meet tomorrow and Wednesday on interest rates. That always makes traders nervous. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's some sporting news today above and beyond Boston bowing out of the chase for the 2024 Summer Olympics. The deal du jour is of the fantasy variety, fantasy sports, that is. The website DraftKings, which lets people play and bet on daily fantasy games in lots of different sports, has gotten itself $300 million in new funding, mostly from Fox Sports. The news comes not long after rival FanDuel raised about $275 million in new capital of its own. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on Old Line Media getting into the growing fantasy sports market.
As part of the deal, DraftKings will spend $250 million advertising on Fox platforms over the next 3 years.
Sports networks, they see this as all additive to their core business.
Eric Fisher is a staff writer for the Sports Business Journal.
Because a fantasy player has been proven over and over again as a more engaged consumer of the games themselves, either in person or on TV.
He means players like Adrian Sharoyan in Queens, New York, who's been playing fantasy sports for 15 years.
When I first started playing fantasy sports, I went from watching only my favorite team, which was the Yankees. And once I started playing fantasy sports, I became instantly more interested in every game that was going on.
Sharoyan's been betting on DraftKings for the last 2 years. He likes that he can make a new roster every day. Sports networks need consumers like him, says Jimmy Lin, who teaches in Georgetown University's Sports Industry Management Program.
The networks are always looking for content to bring eyeballs, and they make their money through the subscription fees and advertising.
And new content, like TV shows focused exclusively on fantasy sports. Networks are searching for new sports programming since the major leagues are already locked into contracts. Given fantasy sports is one venue where it's legal to place bets, more and more people are getting in on the game. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One would have thought, given the way the media world is changing, that next year's presidential election, the advertising for it to be just a little bit more specific, would have been all digital all the time, right? YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, even. You'd be wrong if you thought that. Almost all the money that campaigns have been raising so far to get their messages out has been going to good old traditional TV. Steve Shepard is the campaigns and elections editor at Politico. We got him on the line from the Politico newsroom. Steve, it's good to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Once again, it seems the reports of the demise of television political advertising have been greatly exaggerated.
That's absolutely right. Campaign advertising in 2016 is estimated to top about $4.4 billion. That combines the advertising run by the campaigns and the candidates themselves, and also the growth of super PACs in the post-Citizens United era. It is $500 million more than was spent in 2012 in the last presidential election.
Has nobody told campaigns and consultants and everybody involved with this that the future is all digital?
The future might be digital, but the problem is that the advertising hasn't really caught up with that. The ways in which you can reach people, target them, television, live television is still the best way to do that, and the digital technology isn't really caught up on the advertising front.
One of the things you say is that it's basically tough to spend a whole lot of money on digital because it's so cheap.
That's right. And look, these campaigns and these outside groups are raising so much money. You know, we looked at in 2012, Barack Obama's campaign raised about $1 billion. You know, Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, if they're the two nominees, are expected to threaten that. Plus all the money from outside groups. Where can you spend it? Well, digital advertising doesn't cost that much money. They're raising all this money and they're going to spend it.
Am I going too far if I say that these campaigns are writing off the younger voters who are going to find stuff on Snapchat and Twitter and Facebook and all that?
Probably that's going a little bit too far. Right. They're still going to do that, but by far, about half of their budget, and this includes salaries, half of their budget is going to be spent on television advertising. That's not really where the commitment's going to be.
How much of what's going on here is because the people who are running campaigns and who are consultants to those campaigns are steeped in old line media, and that's what they know how to do, so they're going to it?
It depends on whom you ask. If you ask a lot of the younger consultants, if you ask some Democrats and some Republicans, they'll say that. They'll say that, you know, the same people have been running presidential campaigns for the past 12, 16, 20 years, and they do things the same way. They just buy up all this expensive TV time, and they think that that's effective. When in reality, what they need to do is be more targeted about their television and then also spend more money on digital to reach some harder-to-reach folks.
I imagine that local TV stations and even, some big city TV stations are reading your article and rubbing their hands together going, yes, we're going to make gazillions of dollars.
Yeah, you saw this in 2012. A lot of TV stations, they started adding local news broadcasts, despite the fact that local news isn't necessarily, that popular anymore. Here in the Washington market, two of the three stations have now 4 p.m. newscasts. And the entire purpose behind that is to create more advertising inventory that they can sell to political campaigns and super PACs.
That is fascinating and deeply, deeply depressing all at the same time.
If you live in a swing state or one of the early nominating states, in Iowa, New Hampshire are swing states and early nominating states. So you're going to get the barrage over the winter, and then you're going to get it again in the summer and fall.
Steve Shepard at Politico. He covers campaigns and elections. Steve, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
if you need developers, we'll provide technology. And then when you're ready, we'll go bring you up to Silicon Valley. We'll help you get funded, and we'll be with you for the entire length of your company.
Well, okay then. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 127 points today, 0.7%, closed at 17,440. The NASDAQ off 48 points. That's nearly 1%, 5,039. The S&P 500 down 12 points, about 0.5%, 2,067. If you commute by train, chances are your stops are courtesy of Westinghouse Brakes. Yes, that Westinghouse, founded in 1869. On record earnings today, Westinghouse Air Brake Technologies up 7%. Freight Car America, which makes and rebuilds rail cars, up 0.1%. American Railcar Industries, it makes hopper and tank cars, down less than 0.1%. Today, Grubhub was served a downgrade, and the platform for ordering restaurant meals for delivery cooled off 8%. Why the downgrade? New competition apparently is eating Grubhub's lunch. I love that one. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates. The Conference Board is scheduled to release its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee holds a hearing on exploration of the solar system from Mercury to Pluto and beyond. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's been just about 3 months since the protests following the death of a young black man named Freddie Gray in Baltimore, Maryland. Many of the 400 or so businesses that were damaged in the violence and the looting are still recovering. About 40 of those stores were liquor stores. City officials want fewer of them in Baltimore's poor neighborhoods, saying that they contribute to crime and decay in those parts of the city. So they are denying emergency aid to a lot of those stores. From Baltimore Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
The looters came in through the back, pried open a fence, and tore the door off the frame. They stripped the shelves, smashed the ATM, and busted open the cash registers.
I can't do nothing because it's not one, two, three people. Like more than 50 people.
Michael Gubru owns Doc's Liquors in Sandtown, Winchester. The neighborhood was ground zero during the April riots. Gubru, who came here from Eritrea, says he lost more than $75,000 worth of liquor and food that night. He recognized his own customers among the looters. Gubru has insurance, but if he applied for aid from the city, he'd be out of luck because Doc's is considered a non-conforming liquor store.
They're called non-conforming because it's clear that they're inconsistent with the neighborhood that they're in.
That's Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the mayor of Baltimore. She says zoning rules introduced in 1971 banned liquor stores in certain residential areas, but the 100 or so that were already there, like Doc's, were allowed to stay. Her administration has been pushing to close those stores. So when the city offered emergency loans to businesses damaged in the riots, Rawlings Blake excluded the 20 non-conforming liquor stores, unless they relocate or start selling something else, like fresh fruits and vegetables.
I heard from the residents, I heard from business leaders, with a unified voice that they did not want any city dollars to go towards reopening the non-conforming liquor stores.
One of those residents is Elder Clyde William Harris. He's lived in Sandtown, Winchester for 65 years and founded Newborn Holistic Ministries, a group fighting poverty in the neighborhood.
Any corner where there is a liquor establishment, check those corners out. Hot spots in our community, and we don't need that. We do not need that.
What they do need, residents say, are family restaurants and grocery stores. But those businesses can be expensive to start and difficult to run. Liquor stores are relatively easy to manage and don't require a big investment. Plus, alcohol has a high profit margin, and there's a lot of demand. Abraham Hurdle is a lawyer who represents several liquor store owners. He says they're often immigrant families from Korea, South Asia, and the Middle East.
The vast majority of them are small business owners working 7 days a week often just to put food on the table, put their kids in college, you know, just the same old American dream as everybody else. And I think to say that they're responsible for all the problems that Baltimore has, it's just plain unfair.
If only there weren't so many of these businesses so close together, community activists say. Deborah Furr Holden is an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She drives me to the neighborhood of Park Heights in northwest Baltimore. We pass block after block of boarded up buildings and empty lots until we come to a commercial strip with three cell phone stores, a fried chicken joint, and four liquor stores, with another on the corner of the next block.
That creates a cluster of five liquor stores within a one block area.
One sells some groceries, another has a small bar attached and sells pipes and herbal Viagra. But they have one thing in common. Nearly everything is behind a thick layer of bulletproof plexiglass.
So you literally can't touch the products. You can't browse through the products. I just think it's a very dehumanizing way to make purchases. This is the standard sort of purchase experience for people that live in communities like this.
Good morning. Would you like a bed?
Behind the glass at Doc's Liquors in Sandtown, Winchester, a cashier does a steady business selling sodas and hot Cheetos. Plenty of booze passes through, too. Owner Michael Gubru says he doesn't feel great about selling liquor to obviously desperate people on a weekday morning. But he says shutting down a few stores won't change Baltimore.
The problem is not liquor stores. That's I believe.
What do you think it is?
Everybody knows the problem.
The problem is the lack of jobs, he says. In this neighborhood, more than half of working-age people are unemployed. Gubru plans to stay in business even without help from the city. But stores like his face a longer-term threat. Baltimore is in the midst of its first zoning overhaul in more than 40 years, which could force non-conforming liquor stores to stop selling alcohol. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Not to be forgotten, as Silicon Valley dominates the high-tech headlines, Los Angeles is experiencing somewhat of a tech boom itself right now. Not L.A. proper so much as out along the coast in cities like Venice and Santa Monica, where there are all kinds of startups in what has come to be called Silicon Beach. We're going to spend some time out there this summer in the Southern California startup world, beginning at a technology incubator called Science Inc. It does the usual things an incubator does, providing resources and funding for tech startups, along with some other stuff as well. I sat down with CEO Mike Jones not too long ago. He started Science after a run as the CEO of MySpace.
So I became really excited almost 10 years ago about angel investing. And I became one of the larger angels here in Los Angeles doing most of the kind of earliest stage deals. But when I looked at my track record as an angel, I felt that there was this huge discrepancy between the number of investments and the number of successes I'd had. And even though I was in Makers and Goodreads and some of the big deals, there was just a lot of kind of the early stage where I felt like entrepreneurs failed. And I felt that a structure like Science could actually provide better success for these startups. And I was lucky enough to find supporters where we raised $10 million kind of first month in. And then we put together this great group of people and said, okay, we're going to find early stage companies. We want to partner with them and grow them to be really, really big.
You took $10 million. You rented a facility much like this. You then went out and found your entrepreneurs.
That's right.
You found your companies and said, listen, we've got office space for you. We'll do the back end stuff, let you concentrate on being creative.
Right. We'll work with you on strategy, product. If you need developers, we'll provide technology. If you need designers, we'll provide great design resources. And then when you're ready, we'll go bring you up to Silicon Valley. We'll help you get funded. We'll join your board and we'll be with you for the entire length of your company.
How much time do you spend prospecting, meeting, and taking meetings?
It's almost half my time. Yeah. So, I mean, we'll meet with three or four companies every day, right? Entrepreneurs, early stage, individuals, teams, and narrowly we might select one or two companies a quarter to really go deep with. In addition, I'm spending a lot of time, obviously, with my core portfolio to make sure they're healthy and growing and trying to get over any problems they might be having.
So what are your unicorns going to be? Dollar Shave, clearly
sure,
you believe?
Sure, for us, I think we believe it'll get there. I think that they're on a really, really solid path and are showing like massive disruption in this like men's grooming category. Dog Vacay was one of our early successes. It was backed by Benchmark. It's having like phenomenal success and becoming like this you know ubiquitous, consolidated dog boarding platform.
Just to be clear, it's a dog vacation company.
It's a great alternative to a kennel.
How important is the, and I'm going to guess very important since you're here, is the LA location to you, this idea of Silicon Beach?
My primary network is here in LA. For me, that means I have great access to talent. I can find great people to come work at these businesses. And we also have strong ties to Silicon Valley. So when we have a breakout company, we can pair them with the best investors in Silicon Valley.
Doesn't it, and this is a pejorative phrase, doesn't it gall you a little bit that you have to take your real heavy hitters and take them up to Silicon Valley?
No. I mean, listen, the weight that Silicon Valley carries in technology, it's second to none. There's Silicon Valley and there's everywhere else. And we might be in the top of the everywhere else category, but we're not even close to the infrastructure that Silicon Valley provides for the technology businesses. The wonderful thing about companies like Snapchat or kind of local big breakout companies is that hopefully it will create a lot of wealth here in LA around technology. And when those individuals leave Snapchat, they'll want to support more technology companies because it's how they understand how to create wealth and develop businesses. So I think what we need is we need bigger companies that will create more wealth in Los Angeles, that will provide more returns back to those investors, and then create a larger ecosystem of early stage investment.
Mike, thanks very much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which is both great news and maybe not so great news for the flying public in this country. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of the great state of New York, said today he is going to tear down LaGuardia Airport. Tear it right down and then rebuild it. They're going to break ground on the first bit of the renovation early next year. It's going to take just over 3 years and $4 billion for a new central terminal at LaGuardia, which will be great eventually. If you've ever been to LaGuardia, you know what I'm talking about. But can you imagine the delays? That's all I'm saying. All right, you got to go. The Dow gave up 127 points today, about 0.7%. The NASDAQ off 48 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 down 12 points. That is about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.